BDNG podcast. My name is Tina McKenzie and I am the Education Development Lead for the BDNG. I hope you enjoy listening to the BDNG podcast and find them beneficial to your practice. These podcasts are sponsored by Amaril. Amaril has no influence over the content of these podcasts. Happy listening. Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of BDNG Meets Podcast. My name is Tina McKenzie and I'm the BDNG Education and Development Lead. So today I have great pleasure of introducing Professor Matthew Ridd of Primary Healthcare and University of Bristol, who is funded by the NIHR as a research professor. So welcome today, Professor Ridd, and welcome to this podcast.
Thank you for having me. Pleased to be here.
Absolute pleasure. So today, I know we've done podcasts before, which was absolutely fantastic, but today we're going to concentrate on a study called the Bee Study. So some of our listeners may know about this Bee Study, others may not, but it's a question I often get asked as a clinician in my consultation. Which emollient should I be using? Which one would you recommend? And which one is the best? And I know the Bee Study is going to be answering all of those questions. So firstly, can you just explain exactly what the Bee Study is?
So it was a randomised controlled trial. So if you're trying to determine the effectiveness of something, it's generally considered the best way to do that. Because if you get people into the study and you randomise them correctly, then at that point, they're the same, apart from the intervention you give them. And in this case, the intervention was the four main types of moisturiser, either give them a lotion, cream, gel or ointment.
And it's one of those, I think when you're first starting off in dermatology as well, you know, what is the difference? And you quite nicely wrap that up with the difference between an ointment or a lotion or, you know, a gel, even a foam. There's lots of different preparations out there. Could you quickly just explain the differences between an ointment or a lotion or when's best to apply them?
Yeah, so I like to keep it simple, both for myself, but I think also keeping it simple for patients is probably best. Because people, even with our best intentions, will forget a lot of what we give them. So, and I'm sure you, Tina, and your colleagues will already try and back things up verbally with written information. But essentially, I think of them as being from a fairly sort of watery consistency. So you've got lotions at one end, through creams and gels that are a bit thicker, right the way through to ointments at the other end of the spectrum, really. The manufacturers might make other claims in terms of their differences, in terms of things they add. The moisturisers we were looking at were from those four groups, but if you like, the more simple moisturisers within each of those groups.
Fantastic. And it is, I mean, it's something I think that is getting asked more frequently in our consultations, purely as well because of social media and everything's out on social media. And this is your, you know, wonderful cream for curing your acne or your eczema. You know, it's happening more frequently there. So just a quick question before we go into a bit more into the Bee Study. If I've got a patient that's extremely dry skin with eczema, would I be applying more a thicker sort of ointment treatment?
Well, I think that's a really interesting question because the accepted wisdom, and I still suggest this in my clinical practice now, prior to the Bee Study, was that if you've got a more severe or drier eczema, then patients might get along better with an ointment. But as we'll come on to, the findings from the Bee Study don't suggest that. And I suppose if you're going to summarise the study findings in a sentence, it would be the best emollient is the one the patient will use. And you may say, and your listeners say, well, we knew that, but we didn't know that prior to the Bee Study. But it does at least provide evidence for that statement. So, I would encourage, one thing I'd encourage listeners to think about if they haven't heard about the Bee Study is maybe making room for, gels. I'm sure people are using or recommending creams a lot, but also lotions as well. I think lotions tend to be thought of as, you know, having a more restricted use. But actually, if that's what people are willing to use, then the Bee Study suggests they work.
Fantastic. And it's such a valuable point to say, you know, if a patient's going to use that particular emollient, it's the best one for them, because it I know personally it seems to give my patient the reassurance, and also it's something
as a prescriber, or maybe asking the GP to prescribe, you know, that the patient's actually going to use it and not actually waste it as well. So
yeah, well, I think the context for this was, again, if you want a reliable way to look at the existing evidence, best place to start looking really is the Cochrane Library. Obviously, guidelines are nice and so on, but otherwise, if you want to go in a bit more detail without getting lost in individual studies, and the evidence around the effectiveness of different types of moisturiser was reviewed by Cochrane in 2017, and lots of studies, but not much evidence. So prior to this, there wasn't really a decent head-to-head comparison of the types of moisturisers you all might prescribe on the NHS. And as a result of that, a lot of confusion. And I think people who make these things need to sell them. And so a lot of claims around effectiveness over one over another, but very often without direct comparison with the kind of things we might offer as an alternative, and also without looking at the things that matter to patients, you know, so patient reported outcomes in terms of effectiveness.
Yeah, absolutely. And just, you know, the effectiveness obviously is so important, and what works for the patient. And like you say, limited evidence before that, and it gives that clinician security as well and confidence. When going stripping the sort of B study back as well, you know, to sort of delve a wee bit more into that, who actually took part in the B study?
Yeah, I think that's, again, really important. So these were children with eczema diagnosed by a GP or allied healthcare professional. We did apply diagnostic criteria and found that 80% of them met that, but this was a pragmatic study, so we weren't trying to limit it just to those children who met, if you like, strict criteria. And they were aged between 6 and 12 months, and these were all registered with GP surgeries in three areas of England: west of England, Wessex area around Southampton, and the East Midlands. And they were recruited via 78 GP surgeries. They had to have at least mild eczema when they came into the study. But really, I think, you know, were representative of your typical patient population that are seen and treated mainly in GP surgeries.
Fabulous. And did you have a time limit on the B study? Was it over a certain time?
Yeah, so we followed up everyone. So we ended up with 550 children in the study.
Wow.
The median age was 4 years. The majority of children were under 5 years of age. So again, what is typical, obviously, we had children right the way up to 11 years of age. But obviously, the burden of the disease is in preschool children. We followed them all up for a year. When you design a study, usually specify your primary outcome period. So that's the thing you're going to design your study around, if you like, in terms of the number of people you're going to try and recruit, and when you're going to, over what period. And we looked at the POEM, patient reported outcome measure, which I'm sure, again, yourself and many of your listeners will be familiar with, and we looked at that over the first 16 weeks of the study. And that was also tied into the advice we gave around the emollients. They had to come in when they came into the study. They had to be willing to be randomised to one of the four types, and we encouraged people to try and stick with the type they were allocated to for that first 16-week period. Now, clearly, if they just didn't get on with it or had a problem with it, they were free to switch. But otherwise, we encouraged them to try and persist for that 16-week period, and then for the rest of that period, we followed them up from 16 through to 52 weeks. We said they could do whatever they want, because we just wanted to kind of get a better idea of how much being in the study was affecting their assisting with the molly, if you like, and what people did after that period, and whether that made a difference to their eczema.
That's a really, I mean, committed study and great numbers as well. I mean, it could be quite difficult, especially with, you know, the younger population as well, and having parents on board as well can be very, very tricky. Did you have any issues with recruitment, or did you find that people really wanted to volunteer?
No. That was because we'd done a previous feasibility study. So the only study like this beforehand we conducted again here in Bristol called COMET. And that was essentially to determine whether we could, because to do studies like this, it took several years, a couple of million pounds worth of money. And you don't want to involve 550 families, and that's a good reason. So we did a prior feasibility study just to establish the GP surgeons would take part, and you could recruit people into this kind of study, because obviously, if you found a moisturiser you like and use, you're less likely to want to potentially go into a study being given something maybe you won't get on with. But we established that you know, this kind of study was acceptable to both the GPs that were hosting it and parents. As with all research, even if some parents were allocated something which they didn't get on with and ended up changing, a number of parents were introduced to things they weren't aware of. There was, for example, really low awareness that there are lotions and gels. Most commonly prescribed were creams and then ointments. So again, I think that's another important message, probably from my primary care colleagues rather than people like yourself, Tina. I wonder if you reflect in your practice whether you see a lot of patients that have got to you and only been prescribed multiple different types of cream or ointment, but not had. Yeah. So I think it's really important that certainly in primary care, we just make people aware that there are these four types and that, yeah, it's about finding the one that's going to work for them, really.
Absolutely. And, you know, as I said, there's so many different types. And that's really interesting then, you know, people getting introduced into, you know, different types that they may have not been aware of before. And that just kind of reinforces that education is so important and often dismissed when it comes to emollients as well.
Yeah. So if we kind of go to the findings, as I suggested earlier, we found they were all similarly effective and similar adverse event rate between them as well. So again, maybe a bit less stinging as you might experience from clinical experience with ointments, but otherwise, very, very common. Around a third of participants had, you know, usually a fairly mild kind of localized site reaction. But again, I think that's important to be aware that it is that common and that might be related to undertreatment. So perhaps what they needed was, appropriate topical corticosteroid or some other flare control cream. But otherwise, the message I think they really came out is it's not so much, you know, obviously finding something that people are willing to use is important, but that's not enough. You need to tell them how to use it as well. Mm-hmm. And this was a pragmatic trial, so it wasn't trying to encourage people to use it necessarily. I think there will be an element of that by virtue of taking part in the study. And we weren't trying to enhance other aspects of care. We were trying to focus on comparing the four main types. But we did give everyone an information leaflet that contained really basic information that you would hope people already know. But a number of parents have said, no one had told me about this before, about how to apply it. So again, it's about basic information going a long way, not just giving someone something, but actually telling them where to find the information and how to use it. Yeah,
that's so important as well, isn't it? Because quite often, you know, well, challenges of time as well is not always on a person's side. But again, it's, you know, not to have that education or so many patients that you see and they have no idea how to apply it or when to apply it or, you know, how many times even to apply, or the difference between applications with steroids and emollients that you've mentioned. So you mentioned some sort of information there. Is there anywhere for our listeners to find out a bit more information, any resources at all?
Yeah, so everything related to the BEES study can be found on the website. So that's at www.bristol.ac.uk/BEES-study. Or if you can't remember that, you can go to bristol.ac.uk/ECMO and you'll find some of the resources and you can find your way to the BEES study from that. From the BEES study website, you can look at the original paper if you want. We've done a number of other summaries. So we did a summary for participants and GPs, for example. So in just a couple of sides of paper, it keeps it in fairly lay language, what we found and what we think the importance of the study is. There's an infographic study, so just in a picture, you can kind of have visual representation of the study. There's also a policy briefing. So if you or your colleagues are working with ICBs or medicine management teams and they're not aware of the study, that might be helpful again in terms of giving them a quick summary because they're unlikely to have the time or the energy to go back to the original paper. And then in terms of patients, we've developed what we've called a moisturised decision aid. So again, this is just a two-sided piece of, well, you can print it as A4, it's downloadable as a PDF. And essentially, just on the front page, tries to depict the main difference in the characteristics of the emollients, you know, for example, in their consistency, we talked about. And then on the back, it talks about all the other things they might want to think about. You know, for example, the ointments come in a tub rather than a pump. Mm-hmm. A lot of people would prefer to have a pump. Those kind of issues. Hopefully that's a helpful and digestible way of putting this into practice with your patients.
Yeah, that's really useful resources, and we will provide those links definitely on the back of this podcast as well. That's fantastic. Quick question, did anything really surprise you with the BEES study? Did anything sort of, you know, shock you when you had the results and things?
the people you work with, it's, you know, I'm here representing the study, but there's a, you know, metaphorically there's a team, a small army of people behind me, and many of which of course have now moved on to other projects. And in any study, the person who does all the work, you know, I take the glory, but the people that do the work include the trial manager who labours on this and all the paperwork and the challenges that go with delivering a multi-centre large study like this over several years. And I remember talking with her when we first had the results, and she felt a little bit disappointed. And I think there was a bit of that amongst the team because we hadn't shown that anyone was better than another. But then the more we thought about it, we more thought this is actually still really helpful because lots of people have made claims, and the B study really is the first of many studies, I think, really. It doesn't answer every question. We couldn't compare every different type of moisturiser. But as a starting point, it's hopefully really helpful in terms of saying to people, as we said, you know, it's about being aware there are different types. It's about finding what works for you. It's recognising that it is common to get, you know, some stinging and those kind of problems with it. So hopefully in that sense it's liberating. I think the concern always was that if we did find either one that was better than another, or with the finding where we're saying they're all similarly effective, that it might be a race at the bottom in terms of medicine management teams, or the people saying, right, we'll just prescribe the cheapest then. Because as I've said to you, the key thing that's come through this is, and we did some nested qualitative work, so it wasn't just numbers, it was also interviewing a fair number of people who took part, parents and older children as well. What suited one family or child didn't suit another. And again, you'll know this, Tina, you say, well, we knew this, but, you know, this is evidence now that you can show people and say, you know, my clinical experience is hopefully borne out in the study findings, that, you know, you need to work with the parents and the children to find out what's going to suit them, really. So that was a, yeah, all those things I think were really helpful in some ways, surprising or not surprising findings, depending on how you come to it, really.
Yeah, absolutely. And it is, it's natural things that you come across when, you know, you're talking about emollients with patients, and, you know, just to have the evidence behind it is fantastic. Mm. And I, as you know, Professor Ed, I often quote this sort of B study, and people love the name as well. How did you come up with the name? How is it the
well,
B study?
Well, again, I would attribute the success of the story not only to all the people that I work with, but also we had really good public and patient engagement. So, some of your listeners may know Amanda Roberts, who's been involved in a number of studies and guidelines over the years and was our patient co-applicant. We had a patient advisory group. As I say, it wasn't just the study. We'd also benefited from similar public and patient involvement before in the COMIC study. So one of the many things they got involved in was the choice of the name. And again, thanks to Amanda's and other you know, patient representative wisdom, we actually subtly changed the name of the study. It was originally the best emollient for eczema, and then Amanda and others crewed saying, well, what if we find out that more than one is better? So we actually changed it to emollients, and that was borne out. You know, they were very ahead in their thinking in the findings, really, is about the emollients, the best emollients for eczema.
Fantastic. Yeah, no, Amanda is very inspirational, and she's done podcasts for us as well and spoken for us. She's absolutely phenomenal. But yeah, it is a great name for study. So you mentioned
and obviously we're trying to appeal to the children as well. I mean, the majority of these children were young, and I've still got you we're doing this on a Teams call, but so you can see the B I'm holding up to Tina that we gave out to participants. So it's just a soft toy that we gave. It's a nice thing to introduce those things when you're working with children, isn't it? And we got them to colour in bees. So again, if you go on the bee website, you can see the gallery of bees that were submitted. We've used some of that in the material so that you do recognise that behind the headline findings, where it's all reduced to usually a single line and a p-value, that you've got 550, you know, families that gave up a year of their life and were willing to take part.
It's a great commitment.
Yeah.
Love the bee as well. The bee's a lovely, beautiful, cuddly toy that I'm sure many patients absolutely loved. It's such a lovely thing to do, isn't it? Because it's also gives that person value, and, you know, for mums and dads out there as well, just to understand that people really, you know, trying to drive things forward you know, treating people like individuals, because that's what it's about at the end of the day as well. Yeah. You mentioned there as well about you know, obviously there's lots of other questions that you'd love to know about from the study as well. Mm. Has there been anything since, or is there any plans to do any further studies?
So there were plenty of unanswered questions. I think the findings in the study probably do apply to other populations, and by that I'm thinking adolescents and adults, but this was a study in children, so I think you have to be cautious about that, because I think it's easy to make assumptions, and again, some of your listeners may be familiar with the BATHE study that I was involved in, led by Miriam Santa and colleagues in Southampton, and that was a study you know, seeing whether the addition of bath additive to standard care added anything, and again that was a study in a similar age group of children. But some of those findings were jumped upon because it was seen as a quick way to save money and applied more broadly and to other products, you know, wash products, not bath additives. So that again was our real concern, is that these findings might be misused. So I think in the absence of a similar trial in adults, then I think this is probably as good evidence as there is, but you know, hasn't been done in adults. As we say, you can have a look on the website in terms of the types of moisturisers that we use. They were similar ones within those four groups, but they weren't exactly the same. So, and we excluded some types because we wanted them similar. They didn't include additives or, you know, antimicrobials. So there's all those kind of caveats with it. But I still think for your typical child with, you know, mild, moderate eczema, we did certainly include severity, but, you know, the 80-90% who have mild and moderate eczema, these results are hopefully helpful.
Yeah. Oh, they are extremely helpful, absolutely, and we look forward to, you know, further work being done on the back of this as well. I know your team is just so inspirational. I've worked with, you know, some of your team, and you know what they do with eczema is phenomenal, and that really does, as a clinician, then, you know, being able to say these things to a patient can make such a difference, you know, to just understand that people behind the scenes are working, you know, to individualize their care in a way, you know, to make them feel important.
Hopefully the relationship's bi-directional. I think it's very easy for, you know, for people like me to just do a project, put it out there, and then move on. But thinking about, you know, what sort of projects we do, I think it's really important that we engage with, you know, with people like yourself that are seeing patients day to day, because we've all got different parts of the jigsaw. Mm-hmm. And as I say, working with you know, the people we're here to serve, really, the, you know, the parents and the people with these conditions. And it's probably worth, if you haven't, I don't know if you featured this in a previous podcast, but putting a plug out there for the Rapid Eczema Program.
Yes.
So it's, you know, it's 2025 now, and Amanda Roberts and colleagues in Nottingham are running this. And that's taking this kind of research to the next level, a citizen science level, where, you know, people are involved at the trial management group level and deciding what's done and how it's done. So, and that's answering some of the other questions we have about, you know, the use of these treatments when you're using them. You know, majority of these people probably are and should be using topical corticosteroids along it, and, you know, what order do you apply them in, and all those sorts of questions that we don't really know the answer to.
Yeah,
and inconsistent advice confuses patients. So
absolutely. Yeah. It makes you more confident as a clinician as well, you know, to have these studies. And we have, I mean, we've recorded a podcast on the Rapid with Amanda and Sandra as well. And it was really great just recently to go to the BAD in Glasgow, and it was, you know, presented there as well, which was fantastic. And again, you know, as a clinician, we can say the facts are, you know, this has been reported, so it's so important. So if anyone hasn't heard or would like to know more information about the Rapid, please look on our podcast menu and you will see one there as well. So this has been a very insightful podcast, Professor Ridge. You know, I could again speak to you a lot longer on this topic. I really look forward to, you know, the future as well, what is, you know, going to be developed in the future as well. Like you say, it's all part of the jigsaw. We all have different parts to play. But at the end of the day, it's creating that holistic, patient-centred care. You know, that's what we're all there for at the end of the day. So I really like to thank you very much indeed for coming on to this podcast today, just to explain about the bee study. We will be putting the links in for our listeners today, just in regard to the information about the bee study. And Professor Ridd, is there any key home messages or anything you would like to say before we come to the end of this podcast?
No, I'd just like to reiterate the main findings from the study, really. So in children, using commonly prescribed moisturisers, they're being mostly seen in primary care. It's about finding which one, whether it's a lotion, cream, gel or ointment, the parent and child are happy to use. And if they're happy to use that regularly, then that's the best one for them, really. They're similarly effective, but they're not all the same. So again, just raising awareness, making sure people understand there are these different types. And being willing to work through them in terms of finding something that works for them, and recognising that, the majority of people will need other treatments alongside them, often a topical corticosteroid, and that, reactions are reasonably, about a third might experience a localised reaction. So that might speak to either a treatment with a flare control cream or changing the moisturiser, really. So, yeah. And again, just to acknowledge and thank all the parents that took part, because without them, you and I wouldn't be sitting here sharing the evidence.
Absolutely, a massive thank you to them, and the commitment to for a year is fantastic at that age as well, when everything else is going on in the world the youngsters, so it's a really great commitment. And I'd like to say a massive thank you to you and your team as well, because the work you do is really inspiring, and as I say, it gives us working in with these patients, the confidence and the evidence to back up what we're saying, and provides us with the education sort of pathway that, we're saying the right things. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode. For further information on the BDNG, visit our website, bdng.org.uk, and watch out for the next BDNG podcast, which is coming soon.